Ok, très bien. Donc, Suha Gamri est là aussi.
Voilà.
Bon, on est trois. Donc, on attend, il y a encore 5 minutes.
Ouais. Donc,
hein?
Je me présente.
Mais là, il m'a dit qu'il était là.
Ouais,
donc, là, on voit, il y a 3 personnes pour l'instant. On attend encore.
Donc, là, c'est l'ordre de passage. Donc, je passe en deuxième.
En fait,
ID.
Alors,
ça, c'est
A. C'est les thématiques.
Et A, donc on peut commencer
voilà.
Et A,
en fait c'est ces deux là,
voilà, et plus Sanjay là,
et je pense que ça serait bien que lui commence.
Ouais,
ok,
un,
deux,
voilà, et si Katal arrive, c'est toi, on a un peu de temps encore.
Ouais,
voilà,
okay. Et Katal, je vais,
donc il va arriver.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I think we might get started now. I'm glad to see that the room is reasonably full. Well, firstly, let me welcome you all to Montpellier. This is my hometown, and I'm very happy to welcome you all here, even though the weather's not so good today, but I'm told tomorrow will be a much nicer day. My name is Tom Su. I'm the Executive Director of the International Water Resources Association, which is very much like ECID, except it's not focused on only irrigation and drainage issues. It's focused on wider issues. But I've been working very closely with ECID for a very long time for the organisation of this Congress. On my right is Bruno Moll from IRSTEA. It's a French science and technology research organisation on environment and water. Now, today's session is about wastewater reuse. And as we all know, we're rapidly, if not already, approaching the very limits of our sustainable use of the world's water resources. And we all know that we can't continue with business as usual scenarios, especially with the rapid changes in population that we're expecting and other issues such as climate change. So we need to be looking for solutions not only on the supply side but also on the demand side. And one thing that I'm calling that we need to do is to use our water smarter. And that means using the appropriate waters and the appropriate water qualities for the appropriate uses, which leads us to today's theme, because there's obviously a very huge potential for wastewater use in agriculture. Now, there are lots of questions that remain about that. What is the potential? What are the technical solutions? What are the social frameworks? What are the legal frameworks? And I'm very happy to welcome today various distinguished speakers from all over the world to discuss this. I'll be handing over to Bruno to moderate the session. But before doing so, I just wanted to lay out a few rules. So there will be two sessions this afternoon. There will be 1.5 hour session now, followed by a short break, followed by another 1.5 hour session. Each of the sessions shall have 3 speakers, and each speaker shall have roughly 20 minutes to speak. And I kindly request all speakers to try and maintain their time. We'll give you a short warning, 5 minutes before and 1 minute before. And I think what we'd like to do is also, if you have questions, if we have time within the 20 minutes, we can ask them during that time, but try and save your questions for after the 3 speakers have spoken. We'll note them down, and that way we can have a nice discussion at the end of the session. So without further ado, please let me pass the parole to Bruno. Thank you. Bruno.
Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. So I am Bruno Moll. So I'm working for IRSTEA, the former Semagref, that all the people know. IRSTEA is a new name and complicated to explain, but it is our new name. The mandates are the same, but the name is different. So myself, I am convening a laboratory, what we call the platform, which is gathering a laboratory, an indoor laboratory, which is working on the performance assessment of irrigation equipment and systems, and a farm that could be visited on Wednesday morning, which is located north from the city of Montpellier, in which we have various experiments undergoing on the different aspects of agronomy and irrigation practice and technology. So I think that we will begin the session. So it seems that one of the speakers is not there. So we will have, sorry for our rapporteur, but we will have to just review a little the order of the presentation that was anticipated first. And Is it possible to begin with our colleagues from China, Mr. Xu Xiangli? Did you? Yeah, your presentation is there,
yeah.
And so okay, I give you the floor. Thank you very much.
This one is the pointer. And
it's forward.
This is the pointer.
I think
and forward backwards.
Okay.
Good afternoon. And my name is Zhu Shengdi. I'm from China, China Institute of Water Resources and Hydropower Research, and my working unit. And the presentation of this afternoon, the time-kind effect of natural gas and the water applied on transport equality in soil and residuals within plants and as terrible gross water production for drip irrigation applying secondary sewage effluent. With the increase of water scarcity in the world, and the reuse of reclaimed water in irrigation sector is increasingly. And in many countries, the reuse of reclaimed water is one of the contributors to agricultural irrigation. And for irrigation using reclaimed water, we concern that the one of our concerns is the pathogens, the risk of potential risk of pathogens that contains in sewage effluent. Of the irrigation methods, that's surface irrigation, drip irrigation, and sprinkler irrigation, the drip irrigation is recognized as the most efficient irrigation method that was suitable for sewage effluent, because the when we use drip irrigation, especially the subsurface drip irrigation, we can avoid the direct contact between the sewage effluent and the users. That's one of the priorities of subsurface drip irrigation over other irrigation methods when we use sewage effluent as the irrigation source. And also, many research have demonstrated that the subsurface drip irrigation can improve crop production and improve the quality of products. And our research, the objectives focused on to study the effects of lateral depths for subsurface irrigation and the irrigation was applied on equality distribution in soil and at paragraph lattice when applying secondary effluent, and to compare the production of lattice and give some recommendations for management of drip irrigation systems. Now we move to the materials and methods, and all experiments were conducted in a greenhouse. The greenhouse is 50 meters long and 8 meters wide. The soil was sandy loam with a bulk density 1.44 and the fill capacity 0.33 and the permanent wheeling point of 0.45. And the factor that we considered in our experiments, where the pointer is? Okay. Our experiments, that's the factor concerned with two factors. One is the lateral depth for subsurface drip irrigation. It's zero, the surface, and 10 centimeters below the surface, and 20 centimeters below the surface. And for irrigation levels, we use the 20 centimeter pen to manage of to control the irrigation amount, we use three levels, and the pen coefficient was 0.6, 0.8, and 1.0. And for comparison, we use two water qualities, one is the secondary sewage effluent and another one the groundwater. For each treatment, we use three replications for each treatment, and a total of 36 we have. Our crops were transplanted in 30 centimeters between the row and 30 centimeters along a row. And when the when we host, we collected 16 lotus for each plot. The growth season is from August 28. We transplanted in August 28 and hoisted in October 31. And for equal management, we use the method membrane filter method to measure the E. coli in the soil and within the plants. Now the temperature, and because the temperature is one of the important factors to affect the fate of E. coli, it's the temperature during the growing season is decreased, and the evaporation measured by the pen, 20 centimeter pen, also show a slightly decreasing trend. In total, we 6 irrigation events were applied during the growing season with the irrigation amount from 75 millimeter for the 0.6 coefficient and to 128 for the I3 is means 1.0 coefficient. For what quality? For secondary effluent, we made several of the parameters of water quality, and we may note that the E. coli, because we focus on the E. coli transport and the remains in the plants, that you can find that the E. coli in effluent is variable in during the growing season. It's from 0 to the 100, that's the CFU for 100 milliliters. And in the groundwater we use, that no E. coli was detected. Now we move to the results. And during our measurement during the whole growth seasons, as the very few E. coli were detected in soil prior to planting. It's the prior to transplanting of the crops, we measured the E. coli in soil by soil samples, and we found that the few of the E. coli were detected.
I have to change that.
Okay. We find that the very few of the E. coli is detected in the soil prior to transplanting, and after the harvest, also the E. coli in the soil was not so many. It's, but when we use the sewage effluent to irrigate the crops, we find that following irrigation event, and the E. coli with the relatively more E. coli were found. And just after the irrigation ceased, it's really that we found that it's, when we use in sewage effluent to irrigate the crops, just after irrigation, the E. coli, the number of E. coli in soil is increased. For the plants, it's I find few E. coli detected in lotus leaves, and no E. coli were detected in the stems, along the stems. It's the, we also measure the fate of the E. coli in the soil following an irrigation event. We find that it's the E. coli immediately after the application were applied, it's in the soil, they have a large E. coli in the soil, but after about 7 days, is 1 week, the E. coli will decay greatly. It's almost opposed to the initial condition. It's one of the findings. E. coli decreased from 50 to 60 CFU per gram to less than 15 within 1 week. Also, we find that the three levels, 0.6, 0.8, and 1.0, there are no significant difference between these three irrigation levels. Production. And we find that the production among all the treatments is ranging from 42 to 51 tons per hectare. It's in the normal range of the growing area of the experiments. And we find that in general that the yield of the lotus was increased with the lateral depth. When lateral depth from zero, increased from zero to 20 centimeters below the surface, we find that the general increasing tendency of the yield. And a slightly higher average yield for the treatment irrigated with effluent than that for groundwater, possibly because the sewage effluent contains more nutrients, for example, the nitrogen and the potassium and some other things. Statistically, when we conduct the test of statistical test, with no statistical significant effect, this the lateral depths and the irrigation level, neither of the factors impact the production significantly. That's one of the conclusions. The last of the conclusions, that's from our experiments, we find that the subsurface drip irrigation is efficient in preventing E. coli contamination on soil surface, and E. coli increase in the surface of 10 centimeter soil layer after applying sewage effluent through surface drip irrigation, and the count was decreased to a low level within an irrigation interval of about 1 week. That usually we use weekly irrigation in greenhouse crops irrigated in China. And there was no elevated risk of E. coli contamination of at paragraphs lotus irrigated by either surface or subsurface irrigation with sewage effluent. The subsurface drip irrigation treatments at a pan coefficient of 0.8 produce a slightly higher yield among the treatments. And the drip irrigation applying sewage effluent produces a higher yield than groundwater. And the results may be that suggest that the subsurface drip irrigation with secondary sewage effluent is effective in reducing E. coli contamination in soil and winning plants and improving the production. Finally, the acknowledgement of the support from the financial support from the National Science Foundation of China. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. Thank you very much for this presentation, and thank you for keeping the time. And so we will have more time for discussing this presentation. And what I will propose is to have a short discussion, and maybe at the end, because of the fact that one of the speakers is not there, we have to move a little bit the schedule. So we have two. The first two presentations, which are related to technical aspects or technology, I would say. And the third is more in terms of organization, as far as I've understood, and technology. So what I would suggest is to have a short discussion with this presentation and then to pass to the second and do the same. And at the end of the session, we could have a more general discussion, if you agree. So is there any questions?
You mentioned your system, drip irrigation, reduce the bacterial in your system. Reduce the bacteria. But did you use other system to compare? My other system could also drop the bacteria than the drip irrigation. So like sprinkler, like furrow. So you need to have different treatment, like different irrigation system, to compare with your drip, not the type of irrigation. You compare between the groundwater and the wastewater. So you cannot, And also, I'd like to know what's the unit of the bacteria. And just go back to your presentation. Give me what's the unit. It's very strange a little bit, the unit. What is the unit? It's most probable number for 100 milliliter?
Yeah. Huh? That's what I've understood.
Okay.
Yes.
It's very good suggestion. And we have one ongoing product. We also include the comparison between the irrigation method, sprinkler irrigation, surface irrigation, and drip irrigation. Drip irrigation includes the surface and the subsurface. And the preliminary results demonstrate that even we use the surface irrigation and the E. coli, it's not moved so deep. It's maybe the 10 or 15 centimeters from the surface. It's the depth is not so. So that's the for E. coli. For the risk of E. coli pollution, suppose that the mainly made from the runoff. That's when we have a big precipitation, big rainfall. Maybe the runoff that may move the E. coli to the surface waters. Your suggestion is the. Thank you very much.
Okay. May I ask one question, which is going in the same direction? I was very surprised to see that you have found some E. coli on the leaves of the lettuce when you don't apply this wastewater with the system that is putting the E. coli in the air. So could you explain this?
Yeah, we also have this question. That's for drip irrigation, because that we apply water, even the surface, not direct contact between the water and the leaves. The possible reason maybe that's for example, have some wind, maybe the flow the some E. coli to the leaves. We also try to use the PCR to confirm if the E. coli on the leaves are from the sewage effluent. But the result not yet finished. In laboratory, yeah.
Hello, I'm Philippe Quiroz from Altera, Wageningen University. I have a similar experience, similar setup. The difference is that we irrigate with surface irrigation, and on soil and on lettuce, we also identify a serious drop of E. coli concentration, and we hypothesized that in fact there might be E. coli decay within the drip irrigation system. That's just an hypothesis. We need to test that further. And I was wondering if you tested irrigation water between the drip before the soil, because you might have an effect in the soil, you might have an effect decay in the irrigation pipe. Did you test it?
Yeah, we also conduct some experiments. We invite the influence of the soil application on the amateur probing. It's the find that the sum of the E. coli field is in the pipe. Yes, the accumulation of the like biofilm, yes, maybe we call it biofilm, yes, the accumulation may clog the emitters. One of the experiments we use the chlorination with chlorination injection is for picking up the one month or 1 week, we inject the chloride into that's the kind
Okay, so it's good information to know that E. coli are not able to face effectively the competition with the other microorganisms in the soil. So we were suspecting it, but it's interesting to have some evidences. Do we have, we had one question in the back.
I am Takanori Nagano from Kobe University, Japan. Thank you for the presentation. Oh. Well, my question was just exactly on the mechanism, why the decay is happening in the soil. And I think the chairman already explained. But what are the assumptions that you are making about this decay? That's my question, yeah.
I'll try to answer your question, but I'm not sure that, if I can reveal your impact level. And from the mechanics of the transport of E. coli, that mainly the E. coli was absorbed by the soil from the dynamics. That's the E. coli movement, the transport of E. coli in the soil. The main mechanism is the soil can absorb this E. coli. So this the depth of the transport is not so large, and maybe living as a service of the soil is maybe one of the mechanisms. I really realize that my answer maybe cannot reach you for.
Okay, well, we can discuss later.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, that's okay. I think that we have reached more or less half an hour. At the end of the session, we could have a more general discussion with all together. And I think that we will now invite Sua Gamri to come and present. And she will speak about biofilm development in drippers and dripping systems, and so which is one of the aspect which is, I would say, parallel to the same problem, and that would be interesting to see her light on this aspect, and maybe we will continue the discussion after her presentation.
So good afternoon. I'm Sua Gamri, and I'm working in IRSTEA UMRGO on the problem relating to biofilm, to growing in a micro-irrigation system by biofilm. And I'm going to present you today some of my little of my research work related to the development of biofilm in microirrigation system and its interaction with particle when using wastewater. So this work is realized with the financial support of two projects, the project Water for Clubs and the project NUMA. This presentation will focus on different points. So first of all, I'm going to present you the context and the objective of this work. Then I'm going to present the material and methods used for this research. Then I'm going to present you some results, such as emitter performance using mineral particle and the interaction between biofilms and mineral particle. And then I will finish this presentation by the conclusion and the perspective. So I think the context is the same as the present presentation. We are facing many issues recently, like the population increase, the decrease in water resource, which is due to, for instance, in climate change, and the increase of the use of water in irrigation. So to deal with these problems, we have to find some sustainable solution to feed the world population. One of these solutions is the wastewater reuse using the micro-irrigation. So the advantages of this technique is its highest efficiency. Also, the micro-irrigation is the safest technology for wastewater reuse in agriculture because it reduces the contact between the user, the plants, and the wastewater. However, one of the disadvantages of this technique is the highest sensitivity to clogging, and I'm going to develop more this point later in my presentation. So, here I presented an emitter of micro-irrigation. This is an online emitter which we can plug into a pipe. To regulate the flow rate of this emitter, we have some devices inside emitters, such as this type of labyrinth. These labyrinths are characterized by very narrow section around 1 millimeter, and this side induce and help the glocking. There are three types of glocking. So the first one is the physical glocking, which is due to the deposition of suspended solid. Here you can see some images which represent the deposit of some mineral in the irrigation devices in emitter. The second type of glocking is the chemical one, which is due to the precipitation of chemical when used water for irrigation. We found this problem especially when we use, for example, salty water. The last type of glocking is the biological growth. It consists on biofilm growth or algae growth. Here you can see some photo which represent biofilm growth in the labyrinth of micro-irrigation. So in the field, these three types of glocking are combined, and they cause several problems related to the performance of the micro-irrigation system because they disturb the uniformity of water distribution. Biofilm is an association of microorganisms which attach to a support by the production of protective matrix. So this matrix anchor the biofilm into the surface. The biofilm development is characterized by many steps. So the first one, here is the microorganism attachment. When the microorganism attach to the surface, they produce the protective matrix that can help them to grow. And after a while, after some time, we observe that some microorganisms are released to the surface. And this lead to another attachment of this microorganism to the support. So here you can see some images of some development of biofilm in irrigation devices. Here the photo of some labyrinth of emitter where biofilm develop, and here a biofilm development in a pipe. So I move now to the material and method used for this research work. So we build up in the lab an experimental setup. This experimental setup is composed of a reservoir, 1 meter cubic reservoir, connected to a pipe, a pump, and then connected to a different pipe where we plug it three types of emitter. So we have used three types of emitter for this experiment. Non-compensating emitter, you can see here in this photo the non-compensating emitter characterized by the presence of a labyrinth which regulates the flow. So we have used two MPC emitter, one who deliver 4 liters per hour and other who deliver 2 liters per hour. Then we have used also some PC emitter, which characterized by the presence of an elastomic membranes who replace the labyrinth. So this system operates each hour per day, and we collect the water in the outlet of emitter, and we make them return to the reservoir. Two experiments were carried here using a synthetic effluent that match the quality of wastewater. We use the first one just by using the synthetic effluent, and the second experiment were used by adding some mineral particle to the solution. So for the measurement, we have performed flow rate measurement by collecting water at the outlet of emitter once per day, and we have weighted this container to calculate the flow rate during the experiment. We have also performed the analysis of the deposit that we observe in the emitter by performing the measurement of the dried mass and by using some standard microscope observation. So for the result of this work, here I present the evolution of the flow rate observed when we have performed the experiment with adding mineral particle to the water. So here we observe during the first 30 days of the experiment that flow rate tend to exceed the nominal flow rate of the three type of the emitter. So we observed around 5% decrease for the MPC2, and PC, and around 10% for the MPC4. Then, after this 30 day, we have observed a decrease in flow rate, which means that our emitter start to block. So at the end of experiment here, we have observed a decrease of 17% for MPC2, 23% for PC, and 4% for MPC4, which means that PC and MPC2 emitters are more sensitive to clocking than MPC4. Here I present the dried biomass that we measure for the three different emitters. For three different periods of the experiment, we have measured it in the fourth, fifth, and eighth week. And here we observe that from the fifth week, we observe that the deposit increase, and it's especially observed for PC emitters. Then we also observe that the deposit trapped into drippers is lower for MPC2 and MPC4. Thus, mineral deposit and biofilm growth seems to be related to nominal flow rate, because as you observed in the previous slide here, we start to observe a decrease in flow rate from the fifth week, which match with this result. Okay. Then we have tried also to compare the results obtained using mineral particle. These results are those observed in the eighth week of experiment, at the end of the experiment. And the results obtained without adding mineral particles. So here we have the dried biomass and the flow rates represented by this point. And so we observe here that the dried masses in the experiment done with mineral particle are higher than those measured with particles, without particles, because of the mineral particles that stick to biofilm, which lead to an increase of the dried biomass collected. Also, we have observed that flow rate is less affected when mineral particles are used. So this is a little bit surprising, because we may think that when we add particle and when we have more dried biomass, we are supposed to have much more glocking. That's not the case here, and we make the hypothesis here that maybe some abrasion of the biofilm is realized when we add the particle in the solution. So to conclude, this work helped us to show you that MPC emitters are less sensitive to clocking than MPC2 and PC emitters. Also, we have observed that mineral particles have a little effect on emitter clocking compared to biofilm growth, and this help this. And this may be due to the effect of abrasion of the particle. So in the future, we expect to better understand the effect of blocking in emitters. And for this, we aim to develop the use of microchannel, as you can see here in this picture. So this microchannel have the advantages of the fact that they have a more simplified geometry compared to emitters, which can help us to investigate much more the interaction between fluid particles and walls with experiment and modeling. So we are ongoing some research work is ongoing now in the lab using this kind of devices. And this work helped us to much more understand the zone where the biofilm and the particles start to deposit and develop. Another objective here is to focus in the interaction between biofilm and mineral particle. We expect to use it with treated wastewater to work in field condition. So thank you for attention, and feel free to ask more questions.
So some questions, because you have seen that some of the results are very surprising. So we have some hypotheses that we could develop with you, with Nassim Aitnoueb over there, which has contributed to this work. And so we are waiting for the questions.
Thanks a lot for your informative presentation. I have a question to ask. I think the biofilm growth are highly affected by the pH value of the wastewater. So I want to know which kind of measures are used to control the pH value of the water. And pH value, I mean for the biofilm growth in acid environmental, in the acid environment, if the pH value is less than 7, biofilm growth is very slow. But in alkali environment, if the pH value higher than 7, the biofilm growth will be very quick. So I want to know which kind of measures, in your experiment, which kind of measures has been used to control the pH value, or what's the factor, what's the possible effect of pH value on the biofilm clogging?
Thank you very much for your presentation. I want to learn, did you measure any pathogen or microbial amount in the, your solution or organic amended? No.
We are just measuring the COD and
COT. COD?
COT, carbon, total carbon. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It is very important for carbonide and nitrogen ratio in this water. And in addition to, did you measure in bicarbonate and carbonite level? You know that it is very important for biofilm for the in pipeline.
No. For this experiment, but we have another work which deals with the interaction between chemical and biological protein.
Okay. She tried to, yes, next study, I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, could you please introduce yourself?
From China Institute of Water Resource and Hydropower. I have a question is, just now we learned that the dry mass is decreased for MP4, and the dry mass almost increased for MPC2 and PC, the two kinds. I wonder that do you have the size of the flow path? Do you have measures of the size of the flow paths, and what is the decrease or increase of the dry mass have some relations with the flow velocity or flow path size? Do you do some such work? Thank you.
This project, but in another research work, we have tried to find the link between velocity and biofilm growth. So to better understand the phenomena, we have tried to perform the experiment in just pipe because we have more samples flow, and we have worked with many velocity, and we have found that when we increase the velocity to it's better to show with this slide. When we increase the velocity, we observe that. For this phase, the attachment phase, the biofilm have much more difficulty to attach to the surface. So, for example, we have observed a threshold of 1.2 meters per second. So, before 1.2 meters per second, the biofilm attached easily, and above 1.2 meters per second, the biofilm needs much more time to adhere. And then for the growth period, we have observed that when we increase the velocity, the biofilm grow much more because we encourage nutrients transport, and we had the biofilm growth.
Okay. No more questions, so we are just on time. So thank you, Sua. And we will now move to South Africa. let's pay the tribute to technology.
Give him the microphone.
Let me first of all acknowledge the senior authors of this paper, Nicola Rada from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and of course my former colleague Meiring du Plessis, who was the responsible research manager. They could not attend, so I accepted the responsibility to present the findings and hopefully interest you to go and read the paper and then the published research reports on which this paper is based. It's mainly one report. Over the last 4 to 8 years, we have published 8 research reports, but this paper is mainly based on one report on the guidance. Guidance for the use of grey water for food production. So if I refer to grey water as one specific type of wastewater, of course, and then specifically for food production to improve food security and mainly in homestead food gardens, and these gardens then are in rural villages or in peri-urban and urban environments. So let's first get clarity. What is grey water as defined? It's basically bath, washing and kitchen water. So it excludes so-called black water or toilet wastewater. And some definitions also exclude kitchen water. But in our study, we've included those three forms of grey water. It can vary from 65 to 100% of wastewater, depending whether it's sewered or unsewered. So it's quite a big volume of water over which then household members have control, mainly the women, of course, which they can then be used for food production. I think it's just important to emphasize if wastewater, and specifically grey water, is uncontrolled, it has tremendous negative environmental and health impacts, as you can see on these photos, both in terms of free-flowing water that then, has the danger of people coming in contact and then, of course, getting sick. So why use grey water in the first place? Well, it is an important source of water under conditions of water scarcity, where the demand is higher than the supply at the current cost of water supply. And, of course, there's then tremendous pressure on fresh water or raw water resources. The potential benefits of grey water are then to form a reliable source under the control of the household in the village or urban environment. And it contributes then to food security and indirectly also employment in the whole food value chain from the household up to the local food stalls. And in that process, if the water use is controlled, it of course improves the health of the people that are affected and of course the environmental quality. There are concerns about the uncontrolled use of grey water. Mainly three issues: the impact on human health, impact on plant growth and yield, and if the water comes in contact with the plant, of course, then also the human health, and then the ability of the soil to absorb the different constituents in the wastewater, and then over time still unable to support plant growth. So the question of sustainability of food production. The guidance for grey water use for irrigation and applying water for crop production in then a homestead food garden context is mainly four issues that need to be addressed. The first one is the management of uncertainty and risk, guide to the grey water constituents or the grey water quality, guide to mitigation of grey water quality by different treatment options or agricultural practices, and then the guide to irrigation volumes. And these are all then included in the guidance report that was made available. I will just briefly refer to each one of them, just to give you an idea what each one of them involves. So first of all, managing uncertainty and risk. Of course, the hazard becomes a risk only when people or plants come in contact with or are exposed to the water with the different constituents. So different forms of bacteria measured mainly in forms of E. coli And then if people either get in direct contact or eat the plants, then of course there's a risk of illness. And then the management of that risk involves removing of the E. coli. So the risk can be managed by removing the hazards, improve the quality of the water itself, or then preventing people and plants from coming into contact with the grey water. So increasing the barriers to exposure. And I'll come back to that a number of times because that's the biggest, from a point of education and training and development of skills, that's the biggest challenge, that people are better informed of what are the risks of using grey water. So there are three categories or scenarios of exposure, depending on how this risk is managed. Category one is where there's no grey water analysis or treatment. Then the barriers are quite strict. So then actually grey water should not be used. Then category two is the minimum grey water analysis, and that there's some form of control over the quality of grey water that is used for food gardening. So then the barriers can be slightly less strict. And then category three is where there's full grey water analysis, so it's absolutely clear what the contents of that grey water is, and then the barriers are least strict. So these are different scenarios that enable the water users or the advisors of water users how best to manage then the risk involved. Examples of restrictions, I'm not going to go into detail here, but the restrictions then relate to human health, impacts on the plant, and the plant growth and yield, of course, and then restrictions on the impacts on soil. The guide to grey water quality, the minimum analysis that should be done is on electrical conductivity, the sodium absorption ratio, E. coli contact, and the pH. Those are the minimum requirements in terms of quality, and if it's a full analysis, then it will then include those plus boron content, chemical oxygen demand, the oil and grease content of the grey water, the suspended solids, total inorganic nitrogen, and total phosphorus. So those are then the types of analysis that have to be done. In the case of South Africa at the moment, there are no general guidelines, and our guidance report was an attempt to bring to the attention of the local authorities what the quality analysis should be. At the moment, these are not regularly done, and they're certainly not enforced through any form of regulation or legislation. And that's a major, major disadvantage at the moment. Then forms of mitigation of grey water quality, integrated practices. And this is then specifically part of the irrigation practices or the food gardening practices in a more confined context, in a broader context, the agricultural practices, which will then physical chemical constituents that need to be given attention to, specifically the EC, the pH, and the SAR. And then the treatment options that are available, organic and biological constituents, going then beyond EC and SAR, but what I mentioned earlier, the COD, the oil and grease, suspended solids, and so forth. So different forms of mitigation of quality. And lastly, of those four aspects to manage the scenario of exposure is the guide to irrigation volumes. First of all, and this is standard for all irrigation, a quantitative estimate of the maximum water that can be applied using a reference evapotranspiration, using the crop factor for different plants that need to be irrigated over the whole growing season, and of course then the area planted, which in this case is from a few square meter, 50 to 100 to 200 square meter, depending on the size of the garden. And then in the guidance report, we have presented this in the form of lookup tables that individuals, household members, as I said before, mainly the women that are responsible for food production, can then use as a guide how much water should be applied. And then for the qualitative considerations, of course, one has to go further and do a soil analysis and also determine the frequency of application given the soil type from sandy to clay soils, and then of course also make adjustment to rainfall and the volume of water that is available through rainfall. But the big advantage of using grey water, as I mentioned right at the beginning, is of course if there's a shortage in rainfall, specific types of the parts of the season, then that can be applied and make sure that the crop water requirements for mainly fruit and vegetable are then met. Just a few in closing. So I'm going to give you a lot of time, Mr. Chairman, to take the discussion and the presentation forward. Different forms of collection of grey water in the informal settlement environment, and then applying that manually to gardens or through a simple technique like burying these plastic water bottles that have holes at the bottom, and then pouring the water into those bottles, and that then gradually perforates through the bottle into the soil. Of course, then limiting the contact with the plants. Different forms of preventing contact between the grey water and the plants is, in this case, the tower gardens, where you see there on the left-hand side, by using a simple technique of iron poles and then surrounding those with a plastic cover and then inserting or filling that with a mulch compost soil combination, and then planting the plants on the side. And you can see there on the right-hand side the extent of vegetable production that then is possible, and of course then preventing or completely eliminating any contact between the plant and the grey water, but still having then access of healthy and sufficient quantity of vegetables. And what we also know with other studies then is mainly the diversity of vegetable access that is important for health of the household members. And a different type of production technique, the so-called agri-tubes, used in informal settlements, a similar technique, but then much narrower construction, but also very simple to construct, very stable, basically the same principle, and then applying that directly through putting the moist water into containers and each day then taking the water out of those containers and making sure that the plants have enough water. And then on the right-hand side, you see also trench beds, another form of vegetable production that can be used. Then different forms of grey water treatment, constructing a, in this case, a concrete basin next to the exit pipe, flow-out pipe of kitchen water, and then filling that concrete basin with a mulch, organic mulch, that then can filter the main, let's say, polluting constituents out of that water, and then that water is then used to water the plants. Again, more detail of the whole design and functioning in the report. And lastly, so-called resorption beds that can be constructed, and then the water is applied, and then here the access tubes are planted into the bed to then measure the depth of the water, but also the quality of the water at that point in the bed. So lastly, with this broad overview, is the importance of people. Grey water irrigation or applying water for food gardening, in most cases, as you would have seen through manual means, works only if the people using it are committed to making it work. And this participative action research that we've done has identified three main groups. It will be the users themselves, the household members in rural villages, in urban informal settlements. They have to be first convinced that this is a source that can be used for producing food. And interesting enough, an observation was made that given the, let's say, generally very suppressing environment in which people in informal settlements are living, that it's not seen as a source of water. There's this perception that it's dirty water that cannot be used to produce food. So there's a big perception problem that has to be overcome. And in spite of generally very challenging environment, as I said, in which people are living with lack of sufficient services from nearly all aspects, in specifically in informal settlements, in the fringes of the big cities in South Africa, there is still a resistance to using this water for food production. So it's a major challenge in terms of education, training, and then development of skills. But then, of course, that's the second group of people will be the advisors, typically the non-government organizations that are in interaction with the household members that are living in these rural villages and informal settlements or suburbs in the outlying areas of cities. They have to be also informed of what are the requirements, and that's why we developed this guidance report, that the advice can be given that in spite of the negative perceptions, there is knowledge available and there is guidance available that can be used. And then lastly, of course, the local authorities, the officials in municipal areas that have to then give active support to use of wastewater in the form of specifically grey water for food production. So those are the two target groups, and if we talk of the importance of people, those are then the specific individuals and groups that have to be convinced that it is a way to use water in a sustainable, controlled way, and of course, produce food with all the benefits that I alluded to earlier in terms of reducing the environmental negative consequences and improving then the health and improving food security. So grey water holds both a value for the users, but the users have to be involved and convinced from the beginning. Users have to be given information and trained to use it properly. And then, of course, they have to have a point of call where they can, if they have any questions, they can go for advice. And that's also easier said than done, to get this done over a lot of range of municipalities in different provinces in South Africa is not an easy task. That is the title page of the report that was published, Guidance Report for Use of Grey Water, Sustainable Use of Grey Water in for Agricultural Purposes, broadly defined, specifically for food gardening. That report is accessible on our website if you're interested. The website, www.wrc.org.za. So if you're interested, that report is available. I've got a hard copy here to show you. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, let me close by acknowledging the support for this research. As I indicated, a number of research reports over the last 8 years from the Water Research Commission, the eThekwini Municipality, that's the Durban City in KwaZulu-Natal, the National Research Foundation, and the Stockholm Environmental Institute. And of course, the research partners, apart from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, were involved, University of Cape Town, and then a number of students were involved on this project. And we practice that as a general rule for students to obtain further degrees, honors, or masters, or PhDs on our projects. And these students all contributed to the research output. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, thank you. Thank you very much for this interesting overview. And the questions are now open.
Excuse me. Do you have some idea that what is the percentage of developed country use this kind of methods for grey water? Do you have some idea?
I have to be very honest and say I can't answer you. I don't know how many developing countries are using this form.
No, I am asking about developed countries.
Developed countries.
No, 40 countries.
No, I can't answer you.
Few. Very few.
But of course, for us, the challenge is more in a developing environment. And in South Africa, semi-arid, low rainfall, variable rainfall, increasing competition for water, that we find ways to improve access to the source for food security. So sorry, I can't answer you.
Thank
you. Maybe we can find out in the break if there's an indication.
Okay, thank you. Let me phrase his question by another way. I think you should have an answer. Your system is, my impression is, its applicability is very limited, but for small hold houses and individuals, Vincent individuals. I think more research should be oriented to how we can apply this system to settlement, like at large scale, or scale up the system, like resorts, like new compounds, like this really would have significant impact of using such water, and the volume and the level of using system would be, and also the problems, the challenge would be more different than the problems you are facing now. Because when you have large volume, you need different type of treatments, and you have to have a separate sewer system, and you have to have a pump station, and it looks, we need to look for visibility, economic visibility. So I think we need to move for your research to scale up to for more application, as the gentleman would like to ask, I mean, more application.
Okay. I have to be frank and say I disagree with you. Because in our case, at least 20 to 25 million people live at or below the poverty line, which will fall in this category, living in rural villages or in peri-urban environments. So that's between 2 and 3 million households. So it's quite a significant number. And if we can make a difference to them to improve the food security, as I said, access to more diverse food sources, that will be a tremendous step forward. And then I agree with you in that sense. The challenge is to supply potable water, but that the potable water is then used for basically drinking and in-house bathing and so forth. But that is not used for gardening. The gardening is then, and it's of course also very expensive water because it's purified, so it would be uneconomic to use it for gardening, but rather use the wastewater than for gardening. So okay. With respect, if I understand you correctly, I... Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Mm. All right.
Yeah, but okay. may I add a word? In fact, what is interesting in this type of process is that it is local, which means that you can sell all the collection and the cost of the collection, and you reuse locally, which is giving better trust for the people in this sewage. Also decrease the cost. And if you collect, this makes a problem. On the other way, and I know that, I don't know if there are people from Australia, but Australia is facing some problems because of the decrease of the quantity of water which is used in sewage, generally speaking. So they decrease the quantity of water, and the consequence is that they begin to have problems of self-cleaning of sewage networks. So you have always two sides on the coin, the good one and the bad one.
No, it's okay. I mean, the system is okay, but I mean, my point is this system needs more research to be applied for scale up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, you're right. This poses the problem of separating the different source of pollution. Dr. Al-Ghindi?
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. You mentioned that this system is using in small scales in gardens, but this gray water contains detergents and chemicals. Yes, how this primitive people can deal with such chemicals, yeah. Yes, and treatments?
Yeah, that's why I referred to the different categories, the extent of the analysis that is done, and then the advice to, depending on the constituents of that wastewater, how it can be applied for irrigation. So if it's, let's say, the extreme levels of all those those constituents that I mentioned earlier, then of course you will have to apply it very in smaller volumes or allow for more, how must I call it, dilution factors with other sources of water. So that would be my answer, but maybe we can discuss in the break and look at the detail in the report. So I would argue that the key would be that the analysis and knowing exactly what the content of the water is, the different constituents, and then determining the application rate accordingly.
We have a questions in the back.
So Dimitri Cereza for Ecofilet, France. I've got a question for you. I'm here. You said in your conclusion that it's important to train people. So I'd like to know what were the main difficulties encountered with these users, for example, or the main questions they had during the training sessions. I asked you because with Ecofilet, we train some technical and engineers in France or in different countries, and it's just to be more open-minded.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to now base my response on our general experience with training and improving skills for food production. It's first of all, train the trainers. In this case, it will be the members of or the individuals and non-government organizations, the NGOs that are in interaction, in contact with the households, that they are informed of what can and what should be done. And then, of course, training the officials that they actually allow it to happen and that they support it. So it's first of all training the trainers and then, of course, getting the trainers out in large numbers into the informal settlements and into the rural villages to actually reach out to the households. Again, that is much easier said than done. There are tremendous obstacles of getting that done. And we started the process, and it's what I learned with all other projects that we are involved with, which we want to encourage people to improve their knowledge and skills, is you just never have to give up. You just have to continue and try and find partners as far as possible, as wide as possible, to continue with the momentum. Otherwise, it will never happen. So it's a tremendous challenge, but of course, as I said, in essence, you have to train trainers, so people who have to be prepared to get informed about this and then enter into the village and enter into the informal settlements and engage with the household. So, and we haven't got the solution yet, to be honest.
Thank you.
Okay, some more questions? Yeah, we have one question here.
Thank you. I was hoping I'd have time, but I didn't want to cut off questions from the audience. But thank you, Gerhard, for the presentation. This subject is actually very close to a lot of work that we do, more on the institutional side of guidelines. And you mentioned that it's on an institutional level, it's very hard to get these things done at any level, whether that be in a developing or a developed country. So I've got two questions. These guidelines that you've developed, who are they aimed towards, and what is the status in South Africa insofar as developing guidelines for use of grey water or other types of treated wastewater or non-treated wastewater in general? And secondly, what evidence base or scientific basis do these guidelines have in terms of success? You know, this is something that we're implementing because it's successful, or is it something that we're trying to develop as we go along?
Yeah. Okay, let me start at the end. While this research was done, it was interactive, as I said, participatory action research. So we worked with a number of municipalities and advisors, let me call it broadly. I don't want to be too specific because, to be honest, I don't remember exactly, but there were involvement of the officials and, let's say, advisors to the urban households, and then, of course, the urban households themselves. So it was interactively developed and tested. So we are quite convinced that this guidance, it's obviously not perfect, but it's a start. It's a start, and it should be implemented on a wider basis by actually doing the training and by reaching out to the households. And then if improvements are required, we can then do that over time. So that would be my answer, that it is not a theoretical exercise. This was developed through participatory action research. It was tested in the field, and it was well received by the participants in the project. And then your first question, the main audience, the people that should be reached through this guidance, as I indicated before, is the users themselves, the household members that actually need the water, that they know it is water that is contaminated. So if they have contact with it on hands, by hands or whatever, they have to wash themselves thereafter. And then, of course, if they apply it in the garden, that there are bacteria in it and other harmful constituents, that they should be careful in how they irrigate. And so that's the first main target audience. And then indirectly, those that advise them, the non-government organizations and the municipal officials, the local authority officials. And the big challenge is then, of course, now to recognize that as a source and then to have regulations that guide the application. Maybe also give a drive towards supporting the application of the guidance and then actually supporting people to use the water and produce food. And that's at the moment not there. And a little bit more is written in the paper about that also. So I hope I've answered that.
Philippe Quiroz from Wageningen University, Altera. Thank you for this presentation and the type of research. I really appreciate the methods. So you are focusing on household level, reuse of grey water, reuse of water. When this water enters a ditch beside a house and another ditch, it becomes a river or small stream. Most of the irrigation in developed world, Egypt including, is reusing, when it's not reusing a groundwater with big pumps and a lot of infrastructure, smallholders are using water from small streams, small rivers, big rivers that are open sewers. We know that, technically speaking, they are reusing grey water and treated wastewater. However, because it is not at household level, but in a stream, don't you think that officials and part of the scientific community is blind in front of this current issue that most of the smallholders in the world are reusing de facto grey water for probably since ever?
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, you're quite correct. I think it's happening. But what we wanted to do here in the urban environment is prevent one of the first pictures I showed where that wastewater uncontrollably, let's say, flows down and enters some stream and a river and affects the downstream water through pollution. So that's what we wanted to prevent. But you're quite correct. I mean, all over the world, that is happening. And also in South Africa, because of the uncontrolled flow of water in urban, peri-urban areas and informal settlements, that contaminates the raw water, and that water is then used for irrigation, and that has a food safety implication. So that is it's an increasing problem in South Africa, the lack of sanitation in informal settlements. But the whole idea is to say prevent that water from becoming an environmental health threat and use it at the local level, at the homestead level within a village. So it's a big topic, but we have to start somewhere.
Okay, so thank you very much. Thank you. We are running at the end of the first part of the session. And thank you for the speakers. And thank you for the questions. I give you next appointment in half an hour at 4 p.m. for the second part of the session.